Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Mormon Matters. I am not Dan Witherspoon. This is Scott Holly, and do not fear, Dan is on this podcast, but Dan has been gracious enough this evening to switch sides of the table with me, and so I'm happy to have this great opportunity. Dan, thank you so much for letting me do this.
Loving it. I'm really excited. Big fan of the podcast, so thanks for having me on.
That's right, I will be making Dan's pitch at the end for donations. So, well, a little bit of background. Tonight, what we're going to be talking about, I guess we don't even really have a great name for what we'll be talking about. We have a working title, and part of our conversation is going to be about what it is that we're even calling what we're talking about. But for lack of a better term, for right now, we're going with Middle Way Mormonism. Anyone who has spent time on really any of the boards over the last few weeks and months, it seems like this has been very topical with people formulating and reformulating positions on what is Middle Way Mormonism, is it feasible, is it ethical, and how should we go about it. And I ran into Dan at Boise, the Boise Mormon Stories Conference a little while ago, and we started talking a little bit about this. And I think a number of the recent podcasts have really hit on different points of this, but I found myself kind of scribbling out some questions about things that I didn't necessarily have strong opinions on, which is, you know, for me, kind of an oddity and a rarity, but had lots of questions and had a few people in mind that I wanted to hear their perspectives, and was fortunate enough to have Dan agree to this, and we've got those people with those perspectives on the podcast. So Dan Witherspoon, you heard his voice. Dan, do you want to give an introduction? The man who needs no introduction on this podcast, certainly. But Dan, you want to tell a little bit about yourself?
Wow, sure. As far as what people may not remember is, somewhere along the line, I was a scholar at one time, and then I think I gave that up about 10 or 15 years ago when I became the editor of Sunstone Magazine, well, 2001, so 12 years ago now. And it was at that right time in my life where I had been, you know, working my way into a comfort zone again with Mormonism. So within a year or two of kind of feeling like I hit a stride in a way to be Mormon in a way that felt integrous for me, as well as kind of hit a decent groove with, you know, the wards and the stakes and the friendships and things I had. So just kind of for me, know that I'm, you know, 20 plus years into this journey, and I'm happy to share whatever perspectives I have on this. And it's fun, again, to be on this side of the mic as the host. I sometimes want to, you know, I want to duke it out, and I don't. And so I don't know that there's any duking to be had today, but it'll be fun to be a little bit unleashed. So thanks.
Well, hopefully I'll be suitably provocative if I don't sense any duking coming out of you, Dan. Jared Anderson. So I like Dan's approach. You know, every time you're new on, or every time you're back on a podcast, tell something that's new about you that people might not know. So Jared, you're probably up to about a dozen or so podcasts. So what is it that people who are regular listeners might not already know about you?
Oh no, I've actually never thought of it that way. Yeah, so I'm kind of here and there all over the internet in the past year. I mean, in very small ways. I really like to cook. I don't know. Maybe that's one thing that most listeners wouldn't know when I'm not online.
And Jared is a good cook. Jared, describe your dining room for the listeners.
So we have a very large dining room table, and then we have almost floor-to-ceiling bookshelves all across the dining room, which causes me some anxiety with the proximity of books, thousands of dollars of books, and food, and toddlers. But usually, no more harm is done than my little one-year-old Miriam stacking my vocabulary cards, the Arabic on top of the Greek, on top of the Hebrew, on top of the German. So other than that, we're usually pretty good with books and food and toddlers.
And how many languages is she through now?
Well, as far as stacking vocabulary cards, she's up to about 5.
All right, that's great. Well, thank you for that. And our third guest tonight is actually returning to the Mormon Stories podcast community after, you know, I think that if you have listened to all of the many hours of podcasts in the archives, a couple of podcasts generally stand out in terms of ones that continue to be rehashed and discussed. Both of those were done by the guests that we have on tonight, and that's Andrew Ainsworth. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, glad to be participating.
And Andrew, before I turn the mic over to you to do your little introduction, I'll give the little small world Mormon Stories synopsis of Andrew and I. Andrew was actually my very first Sunday school teacher after I was married and moved to Irvine, California for a few months, and was also the person who organized my very first book club, and was the first person to recommend a book on religion not written by a member of the church. Thomas Merton Seeds was the first book that we read in the book club. I remember at first being very taken aback that there was even a concept of reading a book on religion that didn't carry the Deseret Book stamp of approval, but was a great experience. And so, you know, maybe I can trace everything back to Andrew. Who knows? But Andrew, appreciate you being on. Do you want to supplement that synopsis with maybe a little bit more details for the listeners?
Yeah, just to build on the personal connection there. I don't know if you realize, Scott, but that was the one and only book club meeting we ever held.
Oh, that's too funny.
What we took from that is dudes don't like to sit around and talk about books. But and also talking about the small world of the Mormon Stories community, I actually was contacted by a woman I baptized on my mission because she had heard one of my interviews that I conducted on Mormon Stories, and so we were able to reestablish a connection after many, many years, so that was cool. But as far as my brief little bio, I'd just say born and raised in the church, hit all the expected milestones of, you know, mission and sealed in the temple and activity, etc. Began seriously reexamining my faith in October of 2006, and came upon Mormon Stories during that process, and was a middle way seeker for a few years, and eventually the middle way didn't work out for me, and I resigned from the LDS Church in April of last year, and but I'm still seeking a middle way in life.
Very good, and really excited to hear your perspective, Andrew, and maybe I think we were kind of talking in our pre-conversation that we're hoping to destroy some conceptions about typecast roles. Not that anyone on this call necessarily has them, or that the listeners are the type of people who approach these podcasts with those preconceptions, but excited to hear some interesting back and forth on these topics. So what we decided we wanted to start off talking about, I mentioned that at the outset that we kind of had a working title for this podcast of Middle Way Mormonism, and I think all of us had a little bit of issue even with the title. So as a way to set this up, what we decided we'd like to do is talk just a little bit about, you know, what we are even talking about when we're talking about Middle Way Mormonism. So I'd like to go around and have people give a little bit of a further introduction in terms of how they understand this idea or concept, if there's what problems they see potentially with the phrasing. And then from there, we're going to move into some different things about some different topics regarding whether we feel that the middle way is feasible, some ethical issues that potentially we'll want to consider as it relates to how we relate to other individuals and to the institution, and we'll go from there. So Dan, you were the first to kind of volunteer that the middle way Mormonism term is maybe not the best working title or is maybe something that we can improve upon. So do you want to just talk a little bit about how you kind of understand it and how maybe you might even define it and help us maybe come up with a better way of looking at that?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the best one to start with in the sense of until a few weeks ago, I really didn't have that piece of vocabulary. You know, that wasn't a term I ever used, ever thought about. Today, I looked online and, you know, I Googled it and it was apparently a word that New Order Mormonism sort of uses and whatnot. And I kind of got a sense from them that they're just talking about those who take a less literal approach and yet for whatever reasons want to stay. To me, I guess just it doesn't really matter what term we're talking about here, but I think a lot of people sort of look at this as a strategy. This is a strategy for staying in the church or not in the church or engaging or whatever. And there's certainly the need to be strategic somewhat, you know, as, you know, if you are in Mormonism and you perhaps, you know, have lived into a lot of complexity. But on the other hand, whatever I'm doing or whatever, you know, non-literalness mixed with, you know, strong connection with people, mixed with a real love for Mormon theology and ideas and all of its expansiveness and all that stuff, it isn't a strategy for me. It's not like anything that I have to choose and define and work on every day. It's simply how I approach life in general. You know, I've loved my parents, and at some point in my life, thank you. I still honor you. I appreciate your advice. But guess what? I'm making my own decisions now. I've lived into that point with them. I do that with friends. You know, we all hopefully made it through the peer pressure and the social pressures of youth, and at some point you stand on your own two feet. I do that with every book I read. Every author is being challenged in my head, you know, and stuff like that. So, you know, I find that a lot of folks just haven't gone, for whatever reason, we privilege prophets or we privilege scripture in some sort of way that won't let us do what that normal maturation process of life is all about, which is engage them adult to adult, engage them my mind, my grounding in spirit to their minds and grounding in spirit. So, you know, whatever it is I'm doing in my wards for the last 10 years would in a way that I feel at home and successful and fed, I'm not doing it out of a consciousness that is any different than how I, you know, interact with any community I value, any friends I value, my family. So those sorts of things. So for me, middle way Mormonism, I hate to put it up on the shelf as something other than an embodied, if you're going to say I'm a middle way Mormon, then just at least for me, I'd want to say it's an embodied way of being.
Okay. So I heard that you're initially starting off talking about a strategy for engaging. When I think about strategy, you know, I think business terminology, strategy being, you know, a set of choices that you make in furtherance of a mission that's already set. So would you, if we look at the middle way as a strategy, what do you think the mission or the goal of a middle way Mormon is that's using the strategy of the middle way?
Well, I you know, I'll just have to go to my own journey. I would suppose that within that first really topsy-turvy 5 years of my faith crisis, transition, whatever you would call it, I was having to, you know, weigh those choices of what am I believing now? What am I thinking now? What's exciting my brain now? And knowing that I'm, you know, at least I thought I was alone in my pew, in the pews there on Sundays. And so there was a lot more thinking of how do I fit? Is there a place for me? And many times during that process, I couldn't take it. I had to leave. I had, you know, I had to take a month off. I had to take 6 months off, you know, whatever it was. But for whatever reason, the goal was always this is important to me. I've had great experiences in Mormonism. I love the theology. Holy smokes. You know, again, just that whatever my wiring is, it's to the big ideas, the grand theories. And I love Mormonism stuff there. And so with that in the dance, along with I want to be comfortable on Sunday, I want to be valued, I want my gifts welcomed. You know, it took a lot of working to get to that point where I feel like it came together. So what is the strategy for? What's it aiming towards? Wholeness, peace, rich experience. And I don't know. So I really probably just botched your question. No, what you're saying there, because I think at some point you're right. There has to be a mental energy expended in it. And I just haven't really had to spend mental energy on it for the last 10 years or so.
Jared, maybe moving over to you, do you think that Middle Way Mormonism is transitional, or is it something that, you know, one of the reasons that I'm really glad that Dan's on this call is because, as you said in the outset, Dan, you have been doing this for, you know, 20 years. And there's a lot of people in our community who have, you know, been at it a much shorter time. But, you know, Jared, what do you think? Is Middle Way Mormonism a transition? Is it a stopping point? What does it mean for you?
Well, we should probably back up and talk about terminology first, and then move to how it works and what it is. Middle Way kind of, it leads to amusing thoughts. What was the comment about middle of the road that you thought of?
Oh, the Mr. Miyagi with Danielson. You walk on one side fine, walk on the other side fine, but in the middle, squish like grape.
So we were talking before the call, and we said we could call it roadkill Mormonism. So Middle Way, first defining it, I mean, I do think that it's middle in as much as it's don't, you know, because you don't follow the program completely as dictated by the leaders, but you also don't leave. You know, so it's not, you aren't taking either of the absolute positions. And one thing that I lovingly like to call Dan out on is, and I think that this comes from a position of strength that you're in, Dan, where you say you just live Mormonism in this full, mature way that is a part of you. And I think one thing that needs to be balanced by is to recognize the way that the institution does not tolerate that. Because I think most believing Mormons would say, no, you have to conform, you have to live, you need to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. I think that if that we would hear a lot of members of the church say, well, all we need to do is live by, you know, 6 months to 6 months. And if we live by everything that is said in General Conference, that is what Mormonism is. And so one thing, I'm trying to avoid value judgments. Well, first, one problem with the term middle way is it reifies the boundaries, right?
Mm.
If you are saying you're in the middle, then that is hardening this idea of the boundaries of what's in and what's out. At the same time, I think that we need to be realistic and say, do you know what? Mormon does that. Mormonism does that. Mormonism mm-hmm. very much has strong opinions about what is acceptable, what is not acceptable when you are an approved member of the culture and when you are not an approved member of the culture. And it doesn't take very much to become, you know, to move into that other camp. And so as far as what Middle Way Mormonism is, I would call it a personalized Mormonism, an individualized Mormonism, perhaps using a linguistic term, religious idiolect. There's this idea that we each speak our own language that is very, very powerful. And I think that there are deep, I'll use Dan's word, robust messages within the tradition that affirm that. They say you have personal revelation, you're here to become like God, you're here to grow up, you're here to be mature. One of the strengths of Mormonism is Mormonism is unusual in that we do not stay children, in theory, right? In theology. We don't stay children, we don't stay slaves, we don't stay servants. We become peers with God. And that's in our theology, and yet in our society, it seems like we are kept in the role of children. And so what I think of as Middle Way Mormonism is an examined, thoughtful, mature, personalized, actualized Mormonism that the institution has little tolerance for.
So that's great, Jared. And there are a couple of things there that I think we'll want to really flesh out during this podcast. One of them being that there's probably different dimensions, you know, across which we need to be thinking about Middle Way. And I think we've talked about it, a few different frameworks for thinking about, you know, what it, our Middle Way across what spectrum are we talking about, beliefs or behaviors, et cetera. And then also this idea that Middle Way probably depends somewhat on your perspective. You know, one thing I heard someone say recently is that we all within the church tend to look at the acceptability of orthodoxy and behavior as being aligned just to the right of wherever we happen to be standing at the moment. Would you say that's the case? Or it sounded like you were saying that there may be some more hard and fast lines beyond which you've moved in a less subjective way into what we would call a middle way.
Are you asking me where I personally am, or
a more theoretical question? How easy would you say it is from the outside looking in to identify someone who's approaching a middle way, or do we all have elements of the middle way within us?
It depends on how good they are at it.
Mm-hmm.
As if it's an act, though. See, that's
no. Listen. I think that it does take some acting. In some other contexts, I don't think that that Mormon culture, or at least the messages and conditioning we get, tolerates much more than conform, lie, or leave. And of course, I say that somewhat sensationalistically and tongue in cheek. So how do you tell? So, okay, two answers. In one way, we are all cafeteria Mormons, right? I mean, we are all Middle Way Mormons in that there is no one absolute Mormonism. There is no platonic perfect ideal that you can conform perfectly to. And so the church in and of itself has ambivalence with some positions. Polygamy comes immediately to mind. And so in some senses, we are all, you know, cafeteria or middle way or whatever you want to call it, to differing degrees. And on the other hand, there is a boundary past which the costs increase very quickly of being honest and being authentic. For example, if you are a non-temple recommend holding Mormon in a part of the mainstream church, you know, mainstream American church, there's no affirmation of that choice. You can tolerate it, you can put up with it, but you will always be a project on some level. And that also has social costs. And so I think that that is one baseline for what it means to be a fully participating Mormon is temple recommend worthy, right? Whether you have one or not. And so if either through belief or action, you find yourself outside of that, you have to navigate it some way. You need to negotiate individually with relationships with the institution. In some way, something needs to give. And we're going to return to this, but I think that this is one of the, like, I'll be very straightforward. This whole idea of living Mormonism other than the officially endorsed, trademarked way of being Mormon is virtually impossible to do perfectly and fully. And there will be a cost. And so it becomes this question of what do you want the cost to be? And it's probably a harsher position than, say, maybe Dan would take, but I think there's something to it.
So, Jared, would you say then that Middle Way Mormonism is more reactionary than perhaps proactive if you're talking about finding yourself somewhere within that spectrum related to the church that you didn't necessarily choose to get there? Or is this something that someone can actively choose and say, this is how I'm going to live?
Yes, both, actually. That's a good way of asking the question. So I think that ideally, our religious and spiritual identity and life should be a natural growth and organic progression, right? I mean, we should grow up, we should develop, we should decide what we believe, decide what we feel are the best choices for us and those close to us, how we want to engage with ourselves and God and fellow men, or, you know, our fellow human beings. But so on one hand, I think it is just a very natural growing process. One of my favorite things ever said about this was Chelsea Fife, who has been on this podcast. And she said that the middle way is not what we're calling, what we're talking about, that it's not in or out. It just is.
Mm.
And I think that's very beautiful and powerful. And there are other religious traditions that embrace that. So it's not about where you are. You just are. However, that said, because of the cultural messages and social pressures and the way the fabric of Mormonism and the boundaries of Mormonism, I think that once, if your own individual journey goes in certain directions, you are going to be at tension with your community and with the institution. And then it becomes reactionary. Does that make sense? So the growth can be very organic and natural, and you flower and you develop in the ways that happens. But then you are faced with the question of what to do about it.
So if you've made the choice to go up against the wall, you have to choose once you get to the wall, up, around, back. Is that an appropriate metaphor given what you to describe what you were talking about?
Or take a sledgehammer and blow a hole in it. Yep.
Right.
So this is where. So if you grow in certain directions, there you have to pay a price. The price comes due. And you can make a couple choices. You can say, do I pay the price out of myself, out of my integrity? I want to word it carefully because all of these have validity, have benefits and costs. So you can, even if you feel called elsewhere, you can say, do you know what? I am going to be a full price Mormon. I am going to be a in-the-club Mormon, even though I have concerns, I have issues, I have questions, I have differences. I made this choice. I'm going to stick by it. I am going to be a full-price Mormon. So that's one choice. Another choice would be, you know, I can't do it. I can't engage. The cost is too high. This hurts too much. And so I'm going to leave and have integrity. And then the other option that we're talking about is, and maybe this would be a good segue to what Andrew has to say about the circumstances under which the cost can be minimized, I think you need to say one of two things. You need to say, okay, I am going to live honestly and openly and be authentic, and let's hope that I am under some magically ideal environment where that will work. Or another option is to say, I am going to be careful and diplomatic and tactful and selective and duplicitous. You know, so in other words, I'm going to carefully negotiate my identity and my relationships with the community in such that I can have it both ways, and not necessarily in a negative way, but just say, how can I have integrity to myself and respect the relationships around me? It's an extremely difficult position.
Great, thank you. So, Andrew, what do you think? Middle way Mormonism, is it? I'll let you give your definition, but then want to pick up on what Jared was talking about that acting versus being, and the presentation versus the lived experience. But how do you view this topic of what it is that we're talking about when we talk about middle way Mormonism?
Yeah, just to respond and to build upon a couple of the things Jared expressed. I completely understand the concern about boundaries and not wanting to give too much credence to boundaries, and that, you know, the concern that by even using the term middle way Mormons, we're giving credence to boundaries that we think might not deserve credence. On the flip side of that, I really think that boundaries are inevitable. They're certainly inevitable whenever you're using language. The only reason language is effective as a means of communication is that there are boundaries, there are definitions to words. So I do think there's a certain inevitability to the fact that there's boundaries. And so when you talk about, okay, what are those boundaries, I would agree with Jared that the LDS Church authorities definitely do try to establish some boundaries, although, you know, the church newsroom is constantly reminding us that there's a lot of diversity and fuzziness, you know, on the outer rim of Mormon doctrine about things like race issues or polygamy or things of that nature. At the same time, that's not quite a complete statement. The general authorities have made, in my mind, some pretty serious efforts to establish some boundaries and to give a definition of what they think it means to be a Mormon. And I think Jared used an apt example. One is the temple recommend questions. I think another would be when Elder Ballard kind of standardized the language of a testimony and defined what kind of the core doctrines are, Joseph Smith, Book of Mormon, you know, restoration, living prophets, that those are also attempts at defining the core doctrines. And so I would agree with both Dan and Jared in that if the term Middle Way Mormonism is going to have any meaning, it has to, you know, the boundaries we've got to be talking about is somewhere in between being someone who believes and practices the core doctrines and practices and observances of Mormonism on the one border, and on the other edge of the border, I would say, is inactivity or leaving. And so when we talk about Middle Way Mormonism, I do think that we are talking about trying to find a middle way while remaining active in the LDS Church. I think activity, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan and Jared, but activity is pretty much assumed. Although there may be temporary periods of inactivity, it's ultimately a way that's crafted to help or at least make a continued activity and participation possible. But just kind of one, but like Jared said, in a customized fashion. And just if there's anyone out there who might quibble with the idea that you do have to meet at least some minimum prerequisites to still call yourself a Mormon, whether it's a true believing Mormon or a middle way Mormon, I would just ask the question, you know, we all know that the requirements to be a Muslim are to say there's no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. So if someone rejected that and still called themselves a Muslim, does that make sense? Or if someone rejected the Hindu pantheon of gods and rejected the Hindu holy writ and didn't observe Hindu observances but called themselves a Hindu, what would that mean to you? And I think the same applies with Mormonism. If you reject Joseph Smith, if you reject the Book of Mormon, you reject the core doctrines and practices and observances, and you still call yourself a Mormon, in my personal view, I almost want to say you're not a Mormon. You're certainly not a Mormon in the way, let me just put it this way, you're obviously not a Mormon in the way that the general authorities think of and define the term Mormon. And the whole question is, are you okay with that?
Yeah, Dan, what do you think about that?
Well, again, just you couldn't have meant, I mean, there's a lot of talk about cultural Mormonism or, you know, peoplehood. So you're just talking, so why would you say you're not a Mormon when at least if it's your people, if it's your culture, if it's your family?
Hey,
yeah, I guess I would say, I mean, that's an important question is, you know, words can be descriptors of cultures, or words can be descriptors of beliefs and behavior practices. And so certainly there's people who can identify culturally as a Mormon if by nothing else, by virtue of their heritage. But when we're talking about in the realm of belief and practice, you know, if you reject the core doctrines and observances and whatnot, you know, I think it's, you're on shakier ground.
Yeah. I almost wonder if that door hasn't already been opened for us by a couple of things. One, it seems that the church is simultaneously trying to void the use of the term Mormon on one hand while putting out in with the I Am a Mormon campaign the fact that there is a diversity. I wonder if that doesn't create for all of us the opportunity to say, yeah, it you know, that I am getting the message loud and clear that I am able to own this, and Mormonism, you know, I am a Mormon is something that I can self-describe. Now, obviously that's not going to be, you know, the lived experience if you know, that we don't have a I Am a Mormon commercial with someone who, you know, doesn't have literal beliefs or is publicly espousing those, obviously. But I'm not sure that we necessarily have a clear indicator as well that that you lose the optionality or that you lose that claim based off of belief. What do you guys think? What, Dan, Jared?
Well, I have a couple. This is a really, I don't know how much time we want to spend on this, but it is really interesting. Who does the LDS Church claim as its own, when and why? And so I was thinking about what Andrew said. When would a general authority say someone is no longer Mormon? Well, one of the expansive elements of theology is that every single person who has ever lived and not lived on the planet is Mormon, right?
Right.
Wouldn't
we need to argue that one out sometime still. But,
wouldn't they just say that we're a bad Mormon, Andrew? Or a project Mormon?
Or not in good standing or whatever, yeah.
Right. I think the issue that we're really speaking about, just to be precise, is what is a legitimate Mormon? And I would agree. So when it's in its interest, the church does have an interesting relationship. Like, would the church claim John Huntsman as one of its own? I think so, because if you're famous and, you know, it's in the interest of the church, you do get that leeway. But as far as a legitimate Mormon in good standing, I would agree that the message has been made loud and clear.
Dan, anything to add on to that?
Well, I've downplayed the belief thing. I think I'm a little bit more with those guys in practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because for me, for instance, you know, Andrew used the term, if you reject Joseph Smith. Well, do I reject Joseph Smith? There'd be a pretty interesting discussion about my relationship with Joseph Smith. But, you know, I don't think that every word, you know, that every piece of scripture that came through him was 100%, you know, from God and, you know, all those things. So does that mean I am rejecting Joseph Smith? If I think that Joseph Smith did lots of things that were out of integrity with the Spirit or, you know, what God's wishes would be and God's sitting there going, damn it, yeah, these dang free human beings doing stuff, but you know, this guy's, you know, he's still the one who I think I want to do some work through. Again, I'm not going to say the exclusively most important work in the world. So am I Mormon in those ways, Andrew? So, you know, it's like I'm more interested in what Joseph Smith pointed me towards, and a lot of that was, hey, have these experiences yourself. You have the right to your own revelation. So those things I take very seriously.
Yeah, and you know, my personal view is, it sounds to me like you haven't rejected Joseph Smith. What I'm talking about is more like, you know, would it make sense for someone to call themselves a Buddhist but say that they don't believe that the Buddha shared any enlightening teachings with mankind? I think, you know, boundaries are inevitable, you know, certainly as long as we're using language to communicate, and so, you know, there's some minimum threshold, and people may differ over what that minimum threshold is, but I think my position is that there is a minimum threshold.
Okay, great. So what I wanted to do now is, you know, as we were listing out these questions of understanding, you know, potentially some challenges to looking at strict filters in terms of what we would determine to be middle way in terms of appropriateness or ethics or how to make it work, I found the questions kind of dividing up into Joanna Brooks's framework of belief, behavior, and belonging. And so what I'd like to do now is just...
Now, even though Joanna puts them in reverse order, at least in the Mormonism she...
Correct.
...wants... advocate, yeah. But it's fine to take them in that order, but if you're going to put her name to it, I know she stands for belong first, behavior towards each other, and then belief as the least important.
Right. And I'd like to work it kind of backwards because I think that the belonging is the punchline in a lot of ways in terms of how we're, you know, I think maybe come full circle to what we were just talking about now, Jared, of the legitimacy of claiming the title Mormon as someone who may be approaching a non-traditional path. So what I'd like to do then is throw out a few questions. You know, maybe this is the part where I try and get the fighting going or the juices flowing a little bit, but I think that as I've read on the boards, I think that, you know, some of these questions are the in the trenches questions of the, you know, people who have come up to the wall and are trying to navigate are asking themselves. And so I'd like to pose them to some of these to this group. So starting out with a quote from one of the boards, trying to wrap the message that the church is false in the language of belief is duplicitous and disingenuous. Trying to hide your true beliefs in order to get people to more readily buy your message is a form of deception. Is maintaining silence or not actively dissenting against beliefs that we don't necessarily still hold as, you know, non-literal or, you know, whatever fill in your blank term here, is that duplicitous? Is there an ethical need for someone who, you know, hears something that they don't believe is true to voice it or not? Maybe I'll throw that first to you, Jared.
I had a thought come to me that I've been pondering about our responsibility to communicate with others. With our discussion of the nature of language, Andrew, I think you'll like this. So I pose this question to all of our listeners. If, according to your best knowledge and intuition, you have the sense that your audience does not have the resources, ability, saying that in a neutral way, to understand what you are trying to say, what you mean, that for whatever reason this person cannot or will not understand what you are really trying to communicate, how does that influence your responsibility to be honest?
Mm.
So
I loved that comment when you posted that, Jared. I think it makes a big difference.
So the question is, if you have something very sincere and honest to say in French, but none of your audience knows French, what is the value of saying it? And of course, that is used as an allegory toward how do we communicate with those around us regarding our beliefs. And I'm going to be returning to this, but I think that each of us needs to decide where the contours of our integrity lies. I don't think it's a decision that any of us can make for anyone else. For example, with me personally, it would not be productive for me to be fully disclosive in church. It would do so much damage and cause so much confusion and delegitimize. It would just not be productive. It would not be any more productive for me to be fully disclosive and honest in church than for me to show up naked at church. And I think that there are similar rules of social appropriateness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, there is, on the other side, you can make the argument by sitting in the pews in an LDS church, you are making tacit admissions to things. Mm-hmm. But as an example...
But is it a tacit admission to the belief or that I'm willing to be in this community even with people I disagree with?
Okay,
what's Dan, the
Let's make it simpler. Let's move us and put white clothes on us. And we're in the temple now. I think that if we are sitting in the temple, there's a very high understandable expectation of certain beliefs and practices. Maybe not in church. I mean, in church, you can kind of do whatever you want. Not really, not approved, but there's room there. But if you are in the temple, I think you could make the argument that if you do not conform to the average priesthood leader's understanding of the boundaries of temple attendance, I can see the argument that you are being duplicitous.
So Jared, the thought that comes to my mind when I hear the French analogy or the idea that I'm in a society and that there is a duty to, you know, kind of allow that society to maintain their beliefs without too much challenge if there's that expectation in the community that that's going to exist. Does that presuppose that the things that you aren't speaking up against are harmless? Or for instance, what about the tension where there are things that are spoken or said that you feel there is greater harm for those things to be accepted and believed, that the cost of disabusing people from your perspective of those false notions is worse than allowing them to keep it? Does that make sense?
Well, you're lobbing me a softball because you're expressing your own, like, you know exactly where I stand on this. I was thinking, you know, some Mormons would think there should be no Frenching in Mormonism at all, with the French analogy. So to answer your question, that is my precise boundary,
mm-hmm.
Is harm and ethics. So how I approach my activity in Mormonism is I will let beliefs slide. I will use the language of the culture. I mean, like, let me say really quickly that, for example, when I bear testimony, I very rarely mention the standard testimony glove type things. You know, I don't even talk about Joseph Smith, Book of Mormon. You know, I just testify what I feel to share and what is true. And so I never say things that I never lie in church, but I do use language much less nuanced. And well, I don't problematize things that full honesty would require. However, when I think that harm is being done, I will speak out against it. And granted, that doesn't mean I need to speak out against it every time. I think, and I strongly feel this and try to live this, is I have plans to speak out against every harm that I see in church. It might be on a Mormon Matters podcast. So, but do you see, it doesn't need to be now. It doesn't need to be
in the moment.
Yeah, I think that part of mature decision-making in relationships is you can have goals. But that is my absolute boundary, is if it is causing harm, I will stand up against it. I will speak out against it. But I will be as careful and wise and loving and constructive and diplomatic as to when and where and how I speak out.
Andrew, I want to get your reaction to that, but specifically one question I have in reaction to what Jared said. And Jared, it sounds like that there's a distinction then being drawn between ethical truths or ethical ideas related to ethics and human morality versus propositional truth. And I wonder, and I'd like you to, Andrew, to you know, comment maybe a little bit on whether or not you think that there, that might be a little bit of a false distinction, or if you think that there's, that the harm may extend even into propositional truth, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I would add cosmology. So propositional truths and cosmology. Like, do we need to correct people's cosmology, or can we let it stand and then only challenge them on ethics?
Great.
Yeah, I would say that as a matter, when it comes to the two principles that Jared articulated, those being of be mindful of your audience and also having harm or the potential of harm being the trigger of when you do open your mouth and speak, as a matter of principle, I think there's no reason anyone could disagree with that. I think the only place where folks might disagree.
I don't disagree. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the only place people might differ is in their own judgment of what an audience is and is not capable of understanding, number one. And number two, you know, what sorts of statements are harmful. So let me just drill down on that just a little bit. Going to the, you know, you need to speak, you need to consider your audience when you're speaking. And you know, the easiest example there is, I mean, all of us who are parents know that you have to do that. There's certain things children can and can't understand. And so you need to speak to them appropriately. Although, you know, we all know that there's one of the big gripes or issues that folks who are disaffected with or who leave the church have is that they feel like the LDS general authorities essentially treat all of the members as children, in that it appears that the position they've taken when it comes to church history, to provide a very sanitized, whitewashed, sugar-coated, however you want to call it, version of history, on the assumption that all members are, or most members are, intellectual children who, if they learn the full truth about church history, wouldn't see enough good things in the church to convince them to stick around. And so where Jared and I might disagree, although we might not, I don't know, is, you know, when someone's sitting in that gospel doctrine class and hears someone make a comment, you know, we might differ in our judgment about what people can and can't handle if we were to open our mouths. Going to the second point of harm, I think that too is the most logical, sensical boundary. And I think you tried to have us, you know, categorize the discussion from here in terms of the cosmology and what was the other term? Propositional truth.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, let's take a very common, you know, proposition. Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, or Thomas S. Monson was a prophet of God. Okay. So we all know that people on the boards and in Mormon discussions are going to have a full spectrum of opinions on whether that proposition, whether someone believing that Thomas S. Monson's a prophet of God, is going to be harmful or not. You know, some folks might be sitting there and think, there's no harm in him. You know, even though I don't believe he's a prophet of God, even though I don't believe that there's such a thing as a prophet in the Mormon sense, you know, I'm not going to open my mouth and say, nah, Thomas S. Monson is not a prophet. On the other hand, you know, I can envision some folks thinking that there is some harm to people believing that Thomas S. Monson is a prophet of God in the official sense, in that if they believe that, it's going to cause them to do all sorts of things that they may believe are harmful. For example, supporting Proposition 8, paying 10% of their income, they might perceive those things as potentially harmful to believe. So, again, I couldn't agree more with the principles articulated, but I think people definitely will differ in when they believe their audience is capable or intellectually mature enough to handle information, and what sorts of statements, you know, are harmful.
Yeah, Andrew, I think that's a very generous way to collapse the two categories. I do know a lot of people who think that believing anything that is demonstrably false is harmful, and therefore, or at least that the weight of the evidence indicates that it's not true, that that's harmful. You know, so people who have such a devotion to, and this is where I start parting ways with the hard edges of that approach, but I can see it where they're like, okay, if you hold to something that is demonstrably false, that is harmful, and therefore it is my responsibility to correct you and disabuse you of those false assumptions. So that, for example, no one should ever believe in Santa Claus. No one should ever teach their children that there is a Santa Claus. Something like that.
So,
and I
well, I'll give you an analogy. Well, one out of my real life over the past week. My youngest daughter lost her first tooth last week and was visited by the tooth fairy and got $3. And she realized that was losing teeth was a pretty neat way to make money. And so she got to work on her other teeth. And
oh no.
You can see how you can say that, you know, under most circumstances,
harmful.
In most circumstances, believing in the tooth fairy is a pretty benign thing. But, you know, if you see your six-year-old start to wiggle her teeth and try to pull them out prematurely because of her belief in the tooth fairy, then you might want to step in and, you know, if it's the last resort, I guess, you might want to step in and let her know that there's no tooth fairy. And so, you know, I think people can get the point.
So I am going to move, I think, to the edge of where all y'all are. And, you know, the I think that there is this tension, right, of, you know, the survey that was recently done, you know, one of the things that wasn't tested for but came through loud and clear in the qualitative answers is this idea of betrayal, that, you know, for my entire life, these people have been sitting next to me in the pews, or they've been teaching me in the class. And, you know, in our church, everyone's a teacher. You're a home teacher, a visiting teacher, or Sunday school teacher, or seminary teacher. We are all teachers constantly. We stand up and we say what we believe in it. And it is difficult. You know, I suppose the one option is complete silence. However, so there is that tension of, why didn't that person, whoever it was who knew, who could have told me, why didn't they tell me when it would have been less painful, when I didn't have a family, etc. The responsibility to that person versus the responsibility to the person who they have no intention of seeking it out. If they find something, you know, where they understand dragons might be, they just don't go there because it's absolutely working for them. How do we navigate that tension? Do the people in the pews have an expectation, a legitimate expectation that they are not challenged? And does the person who would want to know that information have a legitimate expectation that the people who are in possession of that knowledge, who are in their community, would tell them about that?
Scott, that's the million-dollar question, that last one.
Oh, I have a whole framework that I've thought of about this approach. I try to be honest, responsive, and not proactive. Like, I'm not really, or I mean, I'm selectively proactive about what I say to whom, when. I think that what the church could do that would be a very feasible, productive approach is, and they're starting to do this, there are little seeds of hope. I think that in our standard curriculum, we need to plant seeds and suggestions that point to the greater complexity of the whole situation. And they are doing that with official statements about the multiple first visions. And we've talked before about, you know, where at the reconstruction of the David Whitmer home, they have the hat, you know, that Joseph put his face in. So there are little suggestions, because the key question is, how does a large community with competing needs all get fulfilled? And it's even sharper than that, because I think when we're talking about questioners and seekers versus those for whom the system works very well, or so they perceive, is that what one needs is actually toxic and erosive to the other. And so what I think needs to happen is to have a system where everyone can get what they want. So what you need is, in the curriculum, you need little hints, little breadcrumbs that point toward the more complicated issue. So I think I've said this on a podcast before. If you're going through the Isaiah chapters, you could say, scholars have theories that Isaiah was written by multiple people over hundreds of years. We are going to be focusing on the theological message, or the message and meaning and what we can take from our lives from these chapters. So you just kind of put it out there. And then what you have is, for anyone who has more questions, you have official resources that go all the way down the rabbit hole, prepared by specialists. So if anyone says, I have a question about this whole multiple Isaiah authorship thing, what does that mean and where is it? There would be a little footnote, password protected or something. I mean, I jest, but this idea. So there's this whole...
Do you have to have a barcode to get it?
Yeah. Just type in apostate, strengthening the members committee here, and you can get this information. So what I need, I think, as questioners, one flaw and one problem that we can get into is assuming that everyone is like us and everyone needs what we need. I was talking to a friend this week, and I respect him tremendously, and he is a genius, but he is a philosophy major, and he basically, I don't want to misquote him, but he basically communicated the fact that if you are not a philosopher, you are not truly human.
That's a the very, unexamined life is not worth living.
That's a very high bar. You know, so one thing that he did say that I remember very clearly is he said, you know, there are these philosophical arguments about if you do good without knowing why, you are not really benefiting it. It's not a virtue. I'm like, who cares? I'm like, I want the masses doing good. I don't care what they think. I don't care what they know. You know, just let them do good. And then what you do is you have the framework. So this is a third step. You have a mature framework of understanding gospel principles. And this is one area where I feel the church fails its members. You have this mature framework of what is the intersection of agency and revelation, and cultural context and revelation, what is the nature of a prophet, what is the nature of a scripture, and so forth, so that whether or not they want the details, they have the resources to go there. Whether or not they want to go in the deep snow, the church provides them snowshoes. Do you know what I mean? Like, whether they take it or not. So one example that I use is not many of us would want to know all the mistakes our parents have ever made. That's just unpleasant. Like, we don't need to know all the details. However, we need to understand that our parents are human. And I feel like a lot of the sense of betrayal that members feel is because the church has not provided these foundational principles by which to examine all the other details and elements. You know, for example, that's one thing I gained and I think, Dan, you may have had this experience too. One thing I gained as in a PhD program in religion is it clarified so much. Even before I had the questions, I was like, oh, right, of course. Of course that makes sense. So I think that we can provide the members with those foundations so that they can take it in whatever direction they want.
So Jared, I love that approach. I think the question that comes to my mind is how can breadcrumbs serve a populace who has been delivered their religion with blunt force trauma? That's probably not the right term. So probably slightly offensive, but you know, we have this idea that you know, when the correlated material is delivered through instruction, there is no need to read between the lines, and hence there's no need to listen for that. Do you think that would be effective in being picked up by the right people, and what about the risk of the people that don't want that and find the breadcrumbs?
Well, I have a, you know, our minds are pretty amazing at confirming our own biases, and we are very self-interested creatures. And I really would trust the individual that if you have the questions, you're attuned to that. And if you don't, you kind of don't hear it. I mean, and you've done enough reading in this type of stuff. I mean,
we had a podcast on that, I think.
Yeah, exactly. We filter data selectively. But wouldn't you agree that once there came that moment of challenge, you would maybe look back at those hints and like, oh, okay. And then I think one thing, like the next... So if you never have the questions, no concern comes up, right? Except like a high level ethical, could you be a better person? Had this been delivered differently? Anyway, we're going to bracket that for a moment. And let's deal with just the basic trauma of faith crisis. So if you went to your priesthood leader and the priesthood leader said, oh, you have questions. That's great. Here are some resources. Go here. And then if they don't have the questions, what's the problem? Or, you know, if they're Googling, if they're on the internet, if they come across a board, won't they make that connection of, oh, right, there was that one tiny reference in Sunday school to it. I think that would be enough.
And can I just build on that, Scott?
Yes, please.
What Jared's talking about, we already have precedents for it within Mormonism. I was in a used bookstore several years back and saw a book by Lowell Bunyan on the shelf and bought it, and I discovered it was what was used as a priesthood and relief society manual in 1954. It was called An Introduction to the Gospel or An Approach to the Gospel, one of the two. And if you were to read it, your mind would be blown, because it is very New Order Mormony. It is very middle way-ish. Even the most basic topics like faith and knowledge, it approaches from a radically different perspective than what you get over the pulpit at General Conference these days. And that's one of the ironies of it. The manuals that were used 68 years ago in Priesthood and Relief Society did exactly what Jared is saying he would like to see one day. When you see, reading together in your priesthood quorum or your Relief Society, statements about how there's certain things in life that we'll never truly know in this life, like the afterlife and things like that, because Benyon defined knowledge in terms of experience, what's in the past. He had a temporal version of faith versus knowledge, where knowledge is experience that's behind, knowledge is backwards looking, faith is forwards looking. Faith is based on your experience, what do you hope to be true in the future? And so anything that's in the future that you haven't experienced, he was fine saying we all should say, we have faith in it, but we don't know it and feel comfortable with that. So no one need feel uncomfortable if they can't say they don't know these things. So there's another precedent more recently in, if you look at the CES manual on church history and you look up what they say about the process of translating the Book of Mormon, and it's pretty darn forthcoming. It talks about, Joseph Smith's general statement about I translated it by the gift and power of God. It mentions the people who gave accounts of him putting a seer stone in a hat. It even points out that at one point, Hiram Smith asked Joseph Smith at a general conference to please give a detailed accounting of the method of translating. Boy, don't we wish he would have given that? Would have answered a lot of questions. Joseph Smith explicitly declined to do that. And it's all laid out right there in the CES manual, and that made it past correlation. And so, can we write gospel doctrine manuals in a way that is as forthcoming as the manuals we give to Institute and BYU religion class students? I think so. I mean, they're adult level courses. So there are historical precedents for what Jared is talking about. I think one of the questions we might want to consider is, why were the manuals in 1954 better than they are now? What happened in between 1954 and now? And I think you can probably identify the source of the problem.
Go listen to the Damon Smith podcast.
Correlation. Hey, Dan? Let me just jump in a little bit, because it was interesting that you went where you went, Andrew, because I was somewhat similar. And first of all, let me say, Jared, I've agreed with you for the last 20 minutes, man. You've been awesome. So I have no qualms with any of your criteria and different things like that. So I'm excited about that. But when you were talking about the breadcrumbs, so Andrew, you went sort of historically within our own manuals. To me, it's just like every one of the breadcrumbs that I would want is in the gospel. There's, if you just appeal to the logic of the gospel, the foundational sensibility of what eternal progression means, or the purposes of life and things like that, you can always throw a breadcrumb that feels perfectly in harmony with it. So it's almost like anytime I want to challenge even something that might be harmful, or I was earlier in that section, I was thinking, probably most of what I do is if I see a narrow or a shallow presentation, if the moment's right, and if I can work my way into the conversation, I'm just always trying to say, here is something richer, but every single time it's something that's within the gospel. I can always point to a scripture. I can always point to a deep sensibility or something like that. So no one is like feeling like what I'm doing to sort of, widen the discussion or deepen the discussion or provide a hint of a way of head if somebody were to want to follow it. It all still feels like it's part of Mormonism to me. And I've just found Mormonism to have all those kinds of resources. Something as fundamentally simple as
Adam and Eve. You know, if you don't want to literally believe Adam and Eve, guess what? Every time you go to the temple, they're basically they're screaming at you that this is not something that you have to take literally.
Yeah, Dan, it's an irony that I also think we can use to ground us. We'll problematize this later in the conversation, I'm sure, but I think that there's a validity to the idea, I'll just put this kind of, you know, bluntly and provocatively, where the middle way Mormon could say to the correlated Mormon, I am more Mormon than you are.
Yep.
And again, that's problematic, and I could...
Yeah, I'm not...
But yeah. I'm just saying... That is a defensible position. You know, if someone was calling you out and saying you are no longer Mormon, you could turn around with historical and theological grounding, you know, and say, no, you know, my way, let's put it a little bit more diplomatically and say my way is as Mormon as yours.
Right.
So does the middle, so I'd like to move off of belief and onto the other B's, but what would you say to the person, the hypothetical person, the person who's asking the question, actually, who just really can't get past the idea that they are going to be sitting there judiciously Sunday after Sunday listening to historical claims, propositional truth that they just flat out don't buy, and they realize that a significant portion of that is driven by a lack of knowledge that maybe you're in possession of. What do you say to that hypothetical person?
They shouldn't go to public schools either.
Well, I would say join me at Madison Square and Garden in Laguna Beach on Sunday morning, and we'll share a nice mocha and some delicious huevos rancheros.
Okay, so that is kind of what I'm trying to get at. Is that
boy, I wouldn't go there at all. I'd say, when did these questions and these complications arise for you, and were you guilty of providing the same environment at one time, and what's happened in your journey that just hasn't yet happened in their journey, and are you willing to allow others to have that sort of thing? And if you're not being fed at an intellectual level or something like that, isn't it still neat to look at the goodness and the desires of the people around you? And, you know, every once in a while, you know, I mean, Gene England, you know, his whole big why the church chooses the gospel, and just that all life is a school of love. You know, what about the times you are called up to repentance by these folks in their simple way or through their pure goodness or something like that? So that's how I would kind of just try to say, is there different eyes that you can bring besides now that I'm alerted to these intellectual questions? Yeah, I'm not entertained by those very often at all at church. Mm-hmm. But my heck, I'm so glad that week after week after week, I am interacting with these people and I'm learning from them in other ways. I'm having rough edges knocked off. I'm having moments of being called up short left and right. And those are all important things in my life that I sort of think of. You know, we were talking a little bit about the tension or running into the wall or something like that. All growth comes on the edges. All growth comes out of tension. Every creativity is a rub of two things. And so, you know, this whole, like, I'm withdrawing, I'm just leaving that community that I'm in tension with for another tensionless state. Yeah, that might be healthy for a while, but my heck, you know, you can't be in the echo chamber, you know? So it's one echo chamber or the other. And I kind of like being in the rub.
Yeah, Dan, right. My response was obviously tongue in cheek, but I mean you've put your finger on an issue that middle way seekers are going to need to confront, which is he never said the middle way would be easy. He only said it would be worth it. And if you look at those recent survey results that the Open Stories Foundation is releasing, you'll see that when they asked the question of what cost have you experienced in losing your belief, and, you know, in terms of on your family relationships, your employment, etc., you'll see one of the interesting findings is that the cost, that those answering that there was a high or extremely high cost, that cost was higher for the folks who remain active. And so...
With the exception of parents and extended family.
I may have missed that one, but you'll see overall that those who leave experience, feel like they, less of a toll is being taken on them. And so I think you put your finger on an important thing, which is, if you are going to be a middle way seeker and still be in the pews on Sunday and in the gospel doctrine class and priesthood and relief society, you're going to have to wrestle with these questions, and you just have to be prepared to deal with that and accept it.
Great.
Yeah, I was going to add that I think I really, it's fun agreeing with you so much, Dan. I bet that'll change in the next B. I agree with so much of what you said, and I do think that we who have been where the people are have a greater responsibility to act charitably and lovingly, because we understand how it is to be like them, and they do not understand how it is to be like us, and therefore the responsibility is on us to act in a loving and empathetic way. And granted, I think we can do that whilst being critical of the entire socialization process that results in that. But there are just fundamental developmental, psychological, sociological realities that we need to deal with. And then if you're bored, come fed, bring a book. But I find most meaning in church when I see it as a service opportunity. And in one sense, religion should also nourish and feed you. And I think that Mormonism is pretty crappy at worship and spiritual fulfillment in some ways. But in the other sense, we certainly have that narrative of, religion as service and love. And there's plenty of opportunity for that in activity in the middle way approach.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.